When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Galazzo, joined once again and as always by Peter Flaherty. What's going on, Peter?
Not much. I'm fired up to be back. It was weird. Like, I know how much I love doing this podcast, but I didn't even realize like how much I love it until I had to go a week without it, and it felt like an eternity until we got to hop back on like we are today. So I'm extra excited to be back on with you.
Yeah, ditto. I mean, I'm very excited as well. I will fully take the blame for last week's absence. I was on vacation celebrating 2-year anniversary with my wife, so I was out hiking around. That was fun, but kind of like you, I did miss the pod, and I also feel like when you take a full week off in the middle of the amateur season, and for the major league season too, I just feel like so much happens while I was away. So I'm basically going to use this podcast, Peter, for you to refresh me on everything that's happening in the draft world, because this week for me has largely been a matter of catching up and just getting back into the swing of things. I spent a lot more time following rap beefs than baseball last week. So I can let you know about Kendrick Lamar if you can cue me in on Charlie Condon and what he's been up to. But
yeah, absolutely. The Kendrick Drake beef, that was that consumed my late night scrolling for the last, however many nights, but
I can tell you that my wife is very glad that it seems to be dying down, because I spent far too much time trying to explain bars to her that she did not care about in the least. So
it's hard to follow when it's a little foreign, but when you, man, taking a week off, a well-deserved week off, like I know I'll freak out when I have to miss like a Friday night.
Do you take those off, Peter? Since you've started working here, I can't remember a single time where it's been like, oh, Peter's on vacation. So
I appreciate the tire pump, but I took a Friday. I took like a, I was unavailable on a half Friday a few weeks back.
Okay. All right. Well, eventually I'll coach you up on how to take some time off. It's just so foreign to you. You're right. It's hard to explain things that are foreign, but no, I feel like today will be a fun podcast and I've seen a lot of this on Twitter recently as well. It feels like more and more people who do not follow the draft year round are starting to get a little bit more excited about it. At least this is the sort of conversation that I'm seeing online, which is, you know, take that for whatever it's worth. But the 1-1 debate, I don't know if it's heating up for you. I'm not sure if you think Charlie Condon is just tightening his grip on that spot, but I wanted to get your thoughts. You as the resident Travis Bezzana supporter, if anyone says they're like driving the Travis Bezzana bandwagon and it's not you, I'm just gonna have to call them out, because I think you and Jeff are at least co-captaining that train. So yeah, Charlie Condon, we have him 1 still. Travis Bezzana, we have him 2. It doesn't seem like those players have gone anywhere over the last few weeks or so. I'll just really quickly run down their current lines, so as you guys are listening, you can kind of be up to speed on what the numbers are like, though I'm sure you're aware of the ludicrous numbers Condon has put up. But at the moment, the Georgia third baseman outfielder, right-handed slugger, is hitting .459, .568, .1105 with 33 home runs. He's already matched Jack Caglione's number from a year ago. 16 doubles. He's got 2 fewer home runs than strikeouts, which is absurd. Leads the country in average, leads the country in homers. And then you got Travis Bezzana, who in any other year, I feel like all the headlines that Condon is getting, it might just be going to Bezzana. And maybe, Peter, you can kind of wave that flag for him. But he's hitting .428, .591, .1006 with 26 homers, which, again, if you had told me prior to the season starting that Travis Bezzana was going to hit 26 homers this year, I'd have been like, oh, well, he's clearly going to be 1-1 with that performance after previously hitting 6 and then 11 in 2022 and 2023. I mean, he's also got just phenomenal walk to strikeout rates, better than Condon. I mean, it's a 26% walk rate and a 10% strikeout rate compared to Condon's 17% and 14% respectively. So both have been phenomenal all year, and it sounds like both are getting talked about in the same tier of prospect that Dylan Cruz and Wyatt Langford were a year ago, which I have to say, like, earlier this year, I did not view them in that tier, but it sounds like at least some people in the industry are doing at this point. I'm not sure if it's a consensus yet, but the fact that there are scouts who think they're the equal of that talent, I think speaks to just how impressive they've been this year. But I've been rambling, so what do you think about all that?
No, not at all. It's a very thorough rundown, and you know, this class gets a lot of flack for, you know, the narrative around it is that it's weaker outside of the top 10, which that's a debate for another day. I have my own thoughts on that, but it shouldn't take away at all from what guys like Charlie Condon, Travis Bezzana, and some of these other names up at the top are doing. You mentioned, you know, what Condon's doing is historic. Like, he's got 2/3 of the Triple Crown covered, and he's right there for RBIs. It's going to be tough to make up 12 or 13, I think it is, but it's going to end up being an historic season when all is said and done. Kind of hard to imagine at this point him not winning like National Player of the Year, Golden Spikes. We'll see how the rest of the season plays out, but the home run numbers, I think, are going to be hard to overcome.
We both vote for that award, correct? At this point, if they said you had to vote for Golden Spikes Player of the Year, is Condon like an easy choice for you? How much of a debate is it?
Yeah, I'd go Condon. I wouldn't take him 1-1. You know who I'd take 1-1. But I, for the Golden Spikes, I'd vote Charlie Condon. Not to give away like who I'd vote for, but like even semifinalists, I think people have a pretty good feel as to who those guys are going to end up being. But they've had torrid seasons. Like you mentioned with Condon, he's going to set the BB Corps record. It's been easy double plus raw power that he has no problem tapping into in game. Like the hit ability has been there as well. And then with Bezzana, I have never seen, and granted, I'm a lot less experienced than you and maybe some listeners of the podcast, but I have only seen 3 players in all of my summers going to the Cape dominate the way that he did. And it's him, Alec Bohm back in 2017, I believe, and Nick Gonzalez in 2019. And Bezzana was probably the most dominant of those 2 guys of the 3. Like, he made absolute mincemeat of the pitching. And I was really excited to see him, you know, live and in person, because he was a guy that I was a fan of even just coming into Oregon State. And the fact where he wasn't Team USA eligible and not going to get poached, like, that was so huge because he got almost a full summer. And I was like, my expectations for him coming into this year were sky high. And he's blown them out of the water. Like you mentioned the slash line, he's hitting .428, 26 bombs. He's got 5 in his last 2 games, 12 bags, 61 walks to 25 strikeouts, which is good for a near .600 on base percentage. And it's just the operation, like I've talked about it so much, like on Twitter and on here and all that, like you guys know how much of a fan I am of it. Like it is just so like he is elite at so many things, like the feel for the barrel, the quality of contact that he generates, the elite level bat speed and explosiveness that he is in the box, as well as being an elite level athlete. Like and with the cherry on top with him is like the makeup. And that's not saying Charlie Condon doesn't have great makeup. I'm sure he does. I can't speak on it, but by all indications, he's a great kid. But like with Bezzana, man, he is that guy is a leader and someone that everyone with whom he shares a dugout just flocks to. I saw it on the Cape. You obviously see it at Oregon State. When he opens his mouth, people listen. And he is an excellent teammate too, and just so vocal on the diamond. And it's not like I wash, like he is such a psycho competitor and just a winner. And like, I think he is a slam dunk, high impact major league player. And at 1-1, I'd take him and not really even think twice about it. Like, I don't even think it's that much of a debate for me, which is maybe a little bit of a hot take with how well Condon's doing, but that's, that's just how confident I am in Bezzano going forward.
Well, I think it's awesome to hear you talk about him like this, because one, I think it's interesting to just talk through the 1-1 debate. I have seen a lot of Guardians fans who think that Condon is just the like no brainer, obvious player. If you don't take him, you're making a mistake. So like for them to hear you put up Travis Bezzano's case for 1-1, I think is really compelling. And also the way you talk about him and how fired up you get about him reminds me of myself with Bobby Witt Jr. And also some of the makeup and leadership pieces and traits that you're talking about reminds me of Oregon State catcher Adley Rutschman. I know for a lot of scouts, when he was coming through the program, like on top of all of his phenomenal physical tools and baseball skills, which I think his game was even more well-rounded than Bezzano, just because you have the catcher defense. And actually, you know what? It's not an exact comparison, but Adley did have some like arm health questions at the time. And I don't know if Bezzano has any arm health questions, but maybe his biggest question is just the fact that he throws in a weird way. But just hearing you talk about him as a leader on the field and the incredible makeup does remind me of Rutschman, because for so many scouts who I talked to in that 2019 draft, that was a real piece that, like, I think even if he didn't have that, he probably would have still been the 1-1 in that class, just considering the profile and the tools and the performance. But for a lot of evaluators, that still moves the needle a significant degree, and the confidence you can feel with just the player having success and dealing with failures and dealing with the grind of a baseball schedule and just being a player that your teammates want to play with and play around, I think is something that, again, like for people who are further away from the field and maybe don't know the players, or you're kind of analyzing it with the data, I think it can be easy to forget about that being meaningful or being important. But I really do think it's super important. So it's just cool to hear you break him down like that and get fired up about it. I love hearing it.
Well, I like that the track record that you have in getting animated about a player like that is with Bobby Witt Jr. So if he even...
I think so. You say that your hot take is Bezzano over Condon, which I would agree. I don't think it's a hot take, even if like consensus is Condon.
I think my hot take is that I wouldn't even think twice about it.
Okay. Well, that might be a little further than mine, because in 2019, I remember I was talking with JJ about this. Adley was like the locked in 1-1. We had him in that spot the whole time. But my take then was like, you know, I really would probably rather have Bobby Witt Jr. because, you know me, I'm a sucker for high school shortstop profiles. His tools were phenomenal, off the charts. I heard great makeup things about Bobby Witt Jr. I think maybe less like vocal leadership from Bobby Witt Jr., but just like really good kid, willing to work, like great instincts around the game. So in 2019, I would have taken Bobby Witt Jr. And right now, I think you could still make a pretty compelling case about which one you'd pick. And it'll be fun if that turns out to be the case with Condon and Bezzano 5 years from now. But let's kind of dig a little deeper into their performances and their numbers, because one of the things that I've found pretty fascinating recently is some of the talk about Condon specifically and his home road splits. I didn't realize the degree to which they were so stark for 2024 specifically. And so I wanted to ask you how much you thought this actually mattered or was concerning to you, because we're certainly in the stage where all of these top players are going to be critiqued and nitpicked at a level that you just simply aren't going to talk about for players who are maybe more day two or day three than the first player off the board. It's just the nature of being the top player. The few warts that you have are going to get pried open and examined at a level that might feel ridiculous, but it's just kind of what happens. So looking at Synergy Sports data here, I have 31 games of Charlie Condon at home. His average or his triple slash is 533, 603, 1225. And for the podcast, maybe it's just simplest to use an OPS number, so you have one number in mind. But his OPS at home this year is 1828, which is ludicrous. And then you look at his 14 games on the road, the OPS is still impressive. It goes down to 1284. Yeah, that's right. Okay, just double checking here. So first question, do you think that is concerning? Because it's just a conversation I've been having today with some people after digging into it a little bit more.
You know, I don't think it's a complete nothing burger. And that's not to say something fishy's going on, but like it is something that kind of just makes you go, a little bit. Just given how drastic the splits are. And I think that you obviously have to take into account that it's 14 true road games. I guess 16 if you count the neutral sites that they've played at, but you've got between 14 and 16. You basically half of a sample size as you do at home.
Yep.
But still though, I like with just how drastic the splits are, like I think there's just something weird to it. And like I don't think something fishy's afoot. I'm not insinuating that at all, but
here's what was pointed out to me that I'm curious if you think this makes a difference. Cuz let me bring up Travis Bizana's home road splits as well, because I think it may be
I saw him.
you're like, Peter's like, these home run splits from Bizana are pretty good. No concern here.
So, he struggles at home. He's only hitting 430.
So yeah, Travis Bizana is home road against Synergy Sports. It's 29 games. He's got a 1553 OPS at home. On the road in 17 games, he's got a 1724 OPS. So like you were saying, better on the road than at home. What was pointed out to me is for a lot of these SEC schools, you would almost assume that every player probably has better home splits than road splits, because for a lot of those teams, their non-conference games early in the season are home games where weaker competition is coming to play them. And I was trying to just find a proxy for talent level, and we can maybe even go through, kind of walk through these home road teams that they've played this year just with their schedules, and let me know what you think about the competition. But one of the quickest proxies for me is just pitcher velocity. If you look at Travis Bizana's home average fastball velocity, it's 89.8 miles per hour. If you look at his road fastball average velocity, this is the velocity he's faced, it's 89.8 miles per hour. So no change. If you look at Charlie Condon though, the fastball velocity on average he's faced at home is 90.1. His fastball velocity on the road is 91.3. So it might not sound like a significant difference, but it's more than a tick of average fastball velocity. And I would imagine the overall talent level and quality of pitching he's faced on the road has been better, just because he's able to do a lot of damage against those early non-conference home series that just aren't typical SEC play. And so that would go a long way in describing this. But then you'd also have to look at every other SEC team and maybe Georgia as a whole to see that it's like the same for all of them. Because that was pretty intuitive for me when the point was brought up. And I'm curious what you think about it.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point to bring up. And then also, I think that like Georgia is notoriously and has like even been like it, the park factor has been brought more into the spotlight this year. Like it is a very hitter friendly ballpark. Like the ball really, really flies there consistently. And when you look at Charlie Condon's home runs, like very few of them, if any, are cheapies, but like it does help where you're playing in a really hitter friendly park. And then in the same breath of home road splits, and I know that the 1-1 debate right now is kind of Condon v Bizana, but bringing in someone else in there, Braden Montgomery from Texas A&M, his home road splits, I think he's hitting 370 at home and then just 280 on the road. Fastball velocity, I think on the road is just an average of half a mile an hour higher. I think it's 90.9 compared to 90.4. So like you're really like you're splitting hairs there. And you look at some of the teams that he's faced on the road, he's gotten Florida on the road. Who else did they play on the road? South Carolina on the road. Not to run all through these, Alabama, like, and LSU. So, I think that you are going to see, especially for these SEC hitters, like they're going to struggle more, on the road and at home than at home. But like, I don't know, it is very interesting just to see like how insane the splits are with Condon.
Yeah. And I would also say like, I'm not overly concerned about the splits with him, because even if you just take the worst side of the splits, he's still OPSing 1284. It's not like he's been bad in either of these directions. He's just been so good at home. You know, when you were mentioning the park of Georgia being a little bit more hitter friendly, the first park I think of all the time when we talk about this is Wake Forest. So I immediately pulled up Nick Kurtz's 2024 home run splits, and he also has pretty surprisingly weird home road splits. At home, he's hitting 293, 463, 663 with an 1126 OPS. If you look at his games away from home, that jumps all the way up to a 1766 OPS, 378, 610, 1156 slug, which is kind of incredible. I would definitely have expected Nick Kurtz to just be putting up more numbers at Wake just because he's playing at Wake. So that's kind of an interesting one. But I am curious that you brought up Braden Montgomery. How close to this 1-1 debate do you think he would be? I know you've long been really excited about him. And maybe the split that's most fascinating to me with Braden Montgomery is not any sort of home-road split, but his left-handed hitter versus right-handed hitter split. I think that is the most fascinating one. I almost wonder if he's a candidate to just stop switch hitting at the next level.
Yeah, one, to your first question with Braden Montgomery, I think, man, in any other year, we're like Condon or Bazzana or even Caglione, but really Condon and Bazzana, if they weren't putting up these video game like numbers, he'd probably be right there in the 1-1 debate as well. Like, I still feel like he will get brought up as like a dark horse guy if Cleveland decides to sign someone for a pretty big haircut up at the top. Like, he'll be a name that gets thrown around, but I think when you really hone in on it, he's on the outside looking in. But for me, at least personally, he's drastically improved his stock this spring, and we've talked about it at length as the reasons as to why. But like, coming into it, I was pretty convicted on him being a top 15-ish or so overall pick and assumed he'd perform reasonably well, but he's thrust his way comfortably into the like a top 5 pick for me personally. Like, he's done exceptionally well. Like, the hit tool is ever improving. He's got a top of the scale arm in right field, the closest thing to an 80 that we have in this year's draft. He's a good athlete. Left-handed swing is beautiful. Same with the right-handed swing, but I like the left-handed operation a lot better, and the splits reflect that. Like, really good athlete in the box, explosive bat speed, plus power. And I'm with you that, I just ditch the right-handed swing altogether and just go left-handed only, and I don't think that would at all hinder him whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm curious how teams are going to view that, how even he himself views that. I do think it's an interesting conversation to have. Like, how much value does being a switch hitter bring you if you have consistently tough splits between those two sides? And I think for Braden Montgomery, I'm actually pretty confident in this. Even going back to his high school days, most scouts seem to like the left-handed swing better, and his production as a left-handed hitter has been better. Obviously, that's the side you would prefer to be better on, just because you're going to be facing so many more right-handed pitchers. But looking at his lefty versus righty splits over all 3 years in college, so his first 2 years with Stanford and this year with Texas A&M, it's a good sample. And I think as we're talking about all of these splits, like especially single season home road splits, you're cutting the data so small that a lot of it, you might just be creating noise for yourself. But with 3 years of college, it's a decent sample. So it's 165 games of him as a left-handed hitter. He has hit 339, 445, 704 with an 1149 OPS. The big number that jumps out is his overall miss rate from the left-handed side is 26%. That's not some elite miss rate, but it's, I think, perfectly solid considering the power he provides. As a right-handed hitter, his slash line, and this is in 101 games, so he definitely has a bigger sample as a left-handed hitter, like I previously mentioned, but he has a 270, 376, 491 slash line, an 867 OPS, and then his miss rate jumps from 26% to 38% as a right-handed hitter. So I just wonder, is the ability to hit from the right side that much more valuable than just not taking the platoon advantage and hitting from your better side at the next level? I'll be very curious how that pans out, how that decision works, and how teams view that moving forward.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. One, I apologize for the, I got a potential spam phone call, so that was extremely annoying. So I apologize, but with Montgomery, I don't know if like what he's done as a right. I'm sure that he's going to get a chance to work on it and try and develop it at least to start. I think it would be a little foolish just to do away with it from the jump, but I'm kind of in the camp of like the production or lack thereof from the right-handed side does not like it's not going to outweigh anything he's doing from like, I don't think it's that much of a profile completer. Like if you take that away, I wouldn't really view him all that differently. So that'll be interesting to see how it pans out. And then speaking of splits, again, and I think it's also, you bring up a key point about not like trying to create too much noise, because you can find warts in any player in the world if you just dig deep enough. Mm-hmm. But with Nick Kurtz from the left-hand side this year, or against left, oh my Lord.
We need these spammers. They're not happy that
I need to start screening my, anyways, Nick Kurtz against left-handed pitching this year. Really small sample, only 47 at bats. But he's hitting .213 with 14 Ks, still taking his walks. The chase and miss isn't really an issue. Like for me, that's kind of a nothing burger. But
yeah. I was about to say, don't tell me that Nick Kurtz can't hit lefties, Peter, because I was so confident with his at bats against Jonathan Santucci. I was like, oh, he sees lefties so well.
Yeah, no, I that's such a small sample size and kind of against the track record. So
the one thing that's interesting with Brayden Montgomery as a switch hitter is you really don't have any switch hitters outside of him in first round consideration at this point. Like just looking at our current rankings, I'm scrolling down all the way to like Ryan Johnson, who's a pitcher, Garrett Schull, high schooler in the 40s. But other college switch hitters, you basically have to go down to like Ethan Anderson, who we rank 59. It feels like an unusually light switch hitting crop. I feel like there's normally at least a handful of switch hitters in the first round. And unless I'm like completely missing someone, I think Brayden Montgomery is the only switch hitter we have ranked in the top 30. So maybe Jeff Ponce is going to be happy that switch hitting is a bit of a dying art in this year's class.
Yeah. It's a weirdly light year in that demographic. And then I guess just for fun with Nick Anderson, that's my brother's teammate, with Ethan Anderson, his lefty righty splits this year, 374 from the left side, 273 from the right. And I know we're getting a little bit deeper down the board talking about Ethan Anderson, but also something to watch. So
yeah, hey, he might have his name called on the first day, so I don't think that is too far down.
Yeah, no, it really just the next switch hitter. So I guess not that far down at all.
You know, the one guy I always think of as a player who I wish would stop switch hitting is Ozzie Albies.
Oh, my Lord. I need to look at his splits.
And his the opposite. So I have his career splits right here. I wish he would just hit as a right-handed hitter because versus lefties his entire career, he has a 929 OPS. Versus righties, he has a 759 OPS. So I've always wondered what he would do if he would just scratch the lefty swing entirely. But I think that still has not happened.
Yeah, no, not yet.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
All right. What else you got, Peter? Any of these other guys you want to dig into a little bit more, or should we move beyond the top players in the class? Really take it in whatever direction you want. It's kind of a freewheeling episode that I've been having fun with. So what's next for you?
Yeah, you and me both. I was going to move off the top crop down to a guy that's becoming less and less of a sleeper, I think, like by the game. And you might know where I'm going with it. You might not.
No clue. I love it. Let's see.
It's Ryan Waldschmidt from the University of Kentucky. And I wrote about him last week, and he has been exceptional for the Wild. Like, on a team that doesn't really have a ton of star power, I guess you could say, like, he has established himself as exactly that. And I think what's also important to keep in mind with Waldschmidt is, like, over the summer, he was off to a really good, I say really good, when it was four games. He was 5 for 10 in his first, like, three plus games on the Cape with a bomb, looking like he was going to have a really good summer, and then a completely freak injury blew out his knee in left field. Like, I don't know the exact diagnosis, so I don't want to speak out of turn, but, like, he needed surgery on it. And, like, he is such, like, a savage and again, like, a big time competitor, where he was, like, up and walking on it just weeks after, like, kind of went through some stuff at the end of fall ball and was in a pinch hitting role at the start of the season, and has, like, since come back and lit the world on fire. He's hitting .358 with 13 doubles, 9 jacks, 18 bags, and more walks than strikeouts. And for me, like, I would not be shocked right now if he ends up, and if he keeps playing his way into, like, a top 2 round draft selection. Like, it wouldn't completely floor me if I hear his name called later on day one, maybe even not so late on day one. Really good, like, strong athletic build at 6'2", 205, thicker lower half. And it's a really simple setup in the box. It's super, super explosive and compact. Comfortably plus bat speed, uses his lower half really well, and, like, his hips really fire. Like, you watch his swing, and when he gets his really good swings off, it's a really, really pretty operation. And he consistently creates leverage in his swing, and he'll regularly get the ball up in the air with authority. So, like, when you talk about these hit power guys, like, guys who have an advanced combination of both, like, he's got a tantalizing one, and it's super underrated. Like, he's got plus pitch recognition skills, really advanced approach. He does a nice job of staying within the strike zone. I think his overall chase rate is still under 20%. Overall in zone contact rate is 89%, including 95% against heaters. And, like, he's shown above average power to all fields. Like, he's been able to drive the ball to the right center field gap, and then it's been borderline plus to the pull side. So he also runs well. He's got advanced baseball sense. And, like, those two qualities have translated well to the base paths as well. So the only wart defensively is that he might, or the only wart, I guess, is that he could end up in left field long term. But I'm a real believer in the bat, and think, like, whether it's in, like, the third to fifth round range or even later on day one, I think that's where it makes sense most for him. And certainly, at least for me, closer to the third, like, second to third, than the fifth right now.
Yeah. He's got a really compelling profile, and I love the way you broke him down, Peter. I don't have too much to add, but just looking into his numbers, what really stood out to me is just that plate discipline piece he mentioned, the overall contact rates, and just how he rarely misses fastballs and changeups. There is a little bit more swing and miss against sliders and curveballs, but even if you just look at his production against all breaking ball pitch types, he's still got an OPS over 1,000. So it's not like he's not doing damage against those pitches. I am curious about what the ultimate power projection could be for him, because it does seem like some of the exit velocity data that we had, at least later in April, I don't know if it's fully up to date for his entire season, but it was pretty impressive at the time, near 109 mile per hour 90th percentile mark, 112 peak. So yeah, it's a pretty compelling profile. I think if he's going to be a corner outfielder, maybe you want to see a little bit more power. He's never had more than 9 home runs in a single season, which he's currently at. So he should break double digits for the first time this year. So that's maybe, like, seeing whether or not he can become more of a power hitter, if he's always going to be this really, I don't even know if he's like a super patient, but the plate discipline piece here, like the amount of contact he makes, like it feels like he would be able to trade off some of that for a little bit more power if he wanted to and needed to. I'm not saying he needs to do that, but yeah, I think he's a really fascinating player and certainly a guy who seems to be trending in the right direction. We've got him ranked currently on the board, but probably quite a bit lower than where he's going to be on our next update.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's been a guy that's really helped himself out. And then another guy that's a little bit deeper down the board than Waldschmidt, and he's not going to go as good as Waldschmidt will, is Sean Keyes from Bucknell. And I know I gave Rafe Parrish some love, both on the last podcast episode and then in my expanding upon that in my five data darlings piece. But outside of Parrish, Keyes is the top prospect in the Patriot League this year. Finished the regular season hitting .416 with 18 doubles, tied a career high in 13 home runs, 57 RBIs, more walks than Ks. And this is on the heels of an abbreviated yet really dominant stretch on the Cape, in which across 10 games, he was 15 for 39, good for a .385 average. With three doubles, four home runs, and 17 RBIs. So he made up for lost time with an ultra productive stretch to end the summer. And like a little bit like Waldschmidt, and I saw this as well firsthand on the Cape, like it's a rather advanced hit tool, like close to above average. There's legit impact to the pull side. Super hitterish look in the box. Like he's a big, strong kid, really simple swing, simple operation. Gets the ball up in the air consistently, and he's done it against high level pitching, and he's going to go back to the Cape this summer, I think, before the draft. So that'll only help improve his stock, and I think when all said and done, he's probably like a sixth to eighth round type of guy. And defensively, similarly, that's the only real question mark. It's like he's played a serviceable third base at Bucknell, but the athleticism isn't really there. He's not super fleet-footed. A move to first base seems inevitable, but I have enough faith in the bat where he's going to be able to hit enough to produce well at that position. So he's another guy to keep an eye on.
Yeah, Keyes, I feel like, is definitely going to be a guy who is like more favorably viewed by analytics people or teams that really put a lot of stock into just the performance numbers. It seems like there is a bit of a split camp opinion on him from the scouts. I'm really curious where he ends up. And I guess typically with those players, especially college players like that, they're going to go near the top end of that range because the teams that want him are going to go grab him. But he's, I think, seventh in the country right now in OPS. It's Charlie Condon, Travis Bazzana, Lyle Miller-Green at Austin Peay. Again, that school has just been, or that program has just been hitting everything. Lawson Harrell at Campbell, Corey Collins at Georgia, Jack Caglione at Florida, and Sean Keyes. That's the list of like qualified OPS leaders. So that's a pretty good group of names to be in. And then obviously his batted ball numbers are pretty ridiculous. It's green across the board when you're looking at all of his major offensive statistics. He doesn't really run much, but he's doing pretty much everything other than that. So that's a fun one, definitely a name to keep in mind and to know, because at some point his name will be called. I'm curious to see when that actually is.
Yeah, and across his 10 games on the Cape last summer, and he'll face a lot better pitching this year with him coming and playing earlier in the summer as opposed to being a late roster addition, but he was chasing less than 20% of the time. Like, saw the ball really, really well. It's obviously carried over to this spring at Bucknell. Like, it is a very cerebral plus approach. And when he swings, like he consistently makes really, really high quality and hard contact. So there's a whole lot of green, as you said. That was a perfect way to put it in terms of the offensive profile. And
I also say that because I have a sheet of like performance numbers for a lot of these prospects and use conditional formatting. So it quite literally for me is green.
I love it. But yeah, no, I like when you get him good and you get him on the right day at the yard, like you could conceivably give the hit tool 55 and the power of 55, like teetering on plus, like it's a really appealing offensive profile. So I'm with you that like it's a little bit of a split camp. Like he's not this super dynamic, explosive athlete. There's no projection. Like what you see now is who he's going to be largely, but like someone's going to be a fan of that. And I think pull the trigger on him middle of day two, especially if he continues to perform well on the Cape. But you mentioned Austin Peay, and like as a really quick aside, I have go to bring up like what that team is doing offensively right now. They have, as a team, they have the Division One Triple Crown. They're hitting .359. The next closest is UVA at .342. They have hit 135 home runs across 48 games. Keep in mind, next closest is Tennessee at .127, followed by Georgia and Texas A&M at .122 and .113, respectively. And then runs, I'd have to actually do the math, but they're averaging over 11 per game, and they've scored 539 runs. The next closest is Wofford at 481. So, like, that, what they're doing as a team, if I get time, I kind of want to write about it, but what they're doing as a team right now is nothing short of just insane. And, like, the ball goes at their park. It ball seems to fly everywhere this year, just given how insane the offense has looked. But yeah, like when you talk about everyone hitting 1 through 9, I think I scrolled through it like for fun a couple nights ago in one of their games. They hung like they put up 20, as they do like three times a week, it feels like. It felt like everyone was hitting over 350, and I guess that's a nice little segue into another guy that I'm a fan of. Is
before John Young. Before you even leave that, I guess if you're still talking about Austin Peay, but a few weeks ago, Tom Lipari for us did his annual mid-major banger piece, and I got down to the bottom of it, and he, for an honorable mention, he just had Austin Peay's entire starting lineup, which I thought was phenomenal. This was back on April 25th, so not too long ago, if you guys want to read that little graph he has, but it basically highlights a lot of what you're saying here. They've just been ridiculous.
Oh, that's awesome. But segueing into the most prospecty guy, I would say, on that team is John Gazdar, who really similar trajectory, I'd say, to Keys, where he was a late addition to the Cape last year, had an excellent smaller sample, actually a greater sample size than Keys. It was across 19 games. He was 26 for 72, good for a .361 average with a trio of extra base hits. And he's carried that over into this year and is like lighting the world on fire and has seen an uptick in power. Like last year at Austin Peay, Gazdar hit .308, 24 doubles with 3 home runs and 35 RBIs. Really solid year by all indications, and had a nice summer, put himself on a lot of people's radars, including mine. And this year at Austin Peay, he's just exploded. He's hitting .403 with 18 doubles, 11 home runs, 48 RBIs, and double the walks as he has strikeouts. He's got 25 walks to just 12 strikeouts, and the bat to ball ability with him, like it's borderline double plus. Like it's a 93% in zone contact rate, including 96%, I believe, against sliders. Over the summer on the Cape, he didn't swing and miss at a single breaking ball in the zone. Like the hand eye and hit ability are both, they're both outstanding. He just sprays line drives all over the yard. He's driving the baseball a little bit more with authority this year. He's solid on the dirt. He's got an average arm, over there. And like, he's held his own over at shortstop and is fine over there collegiately, but I think the actions and skill set project long term at second base. But I think before the season I had him as like a day three guy. Right now he could go pretty like he could go reasonably early, I think, on day two. Like fifth to seventh round wouldn't totally floor me. Yeah. Like the hit tool, I think, is plus. That you're not buying the impact and power prowess here, but there is at least a semblance of it where like he can shoot a gap or occasionally drive the ball over the fence, but like the contact ability is, you know, it's borderline elite.
Yeah, it's been fun to watch him this season. We've got him currently ranked inside the top 300, which would be where like your day two names are inside that range. But Peter, I kind of want to switch things up here and talk about a player who maybe is not trending in the right direction. We don't have to bang on him too much. But after just looking at some of these performance numbers and, again, catching up with what happened over the last few weeks, one player who has really struggled this year, and it's been tough to see because he was like one of the players I was relying on to give us some of the shortstop capital in the first round early on in the year, is Anthony Silva. I believe we started him out. I can actually pull up and see exactly where we had him ranked in our preseason. He was either right at the back of the first round range or he was just beyond that. So in July of 23 on our, this is just our college list. So let's see our first combined list. So he was right at number 30 on our February 1st top 200 list entering the season. So a borderline first round talent. We have him ranked in the 70s currently, and he has really taken a step back seemingly across the board this year as a hitter and a defender, which I was really surprised to hear about him as a defender not looking as good. Like, I've heard some scouts who think he might be a second baseman, which is just so different than what I would have thought for him. But after 2023, or in 2023 for TCU, he hit 330, 416, 471. He's currently hitting 241, 346, 335. More strikeouts. He's walking a little bit more, but everything is down. Just of our ranked college players, his OPS is one of the worst marks of any of the players we have currently ranked, and that's also including some guys who are not currently on a list. Like, I'll be very curious to see what Anthony Silva does. This is just his second year at TCU. He's a draft-eligible sophomore, but it has not been a great season for him, and I'm very bummed about it.
Yeah, I mean, last year I could not, and really felt like everyone could not be higher on him. Like, he, as a true freshman, he goes out, wins the starting shortstop job. It's 330 with 11 doubles, 7 home runs, is a catalyst on that College World Series team, shows well in Omaha. And then in what was kind of a harbinger to this spring, he struggled in his stint with Team USA. I know you probably saw him live, but when I went and looked at how he did, because it's his only college performance with Wood, I think it was 1-for-11 or 1-for-12 with 6 Ks, which, again, a crumb of a crumb of the cookie, but not encouraging and not what you wanted to see. And then this year it's been a step back really across the board. As you mentioned, like, the impact is down, the hit ability is down, there are a lot more questions about where he ends up defensively, which is not great, because previously, if you want to even call it this, like, his defense was his carrying tool. Like, yeah, he was this.
I always think about him as one of the better defensive shortstops in the class on the college side.
And he made, like, in Omaha and during the season last year, like, he made a handful of big league plays. Like, there was one in Omaha, and I'll remember it for a long time, where it's against Oral Roberts, hard hit ground ball up the middle, quick first step. Slides going to his glove side, pops up and makes a really strong, accurate throw over to first base, all in like one fell swoop. And it was, you know, there was a collective gasp in the stadium when he made that play as a freshman. I was like, this kid's a serious baller. So
yeah, and I thought this was the case, but I had to double check now as you're talking just to make sure. But on our preseason College All-America team and best tools voting, the industry voted him as the best defensive infielder in the class. And I feel like the list of names here is pretty telling about the relative weakness of the up the middle defenders in the college class, because it's Anthony Silva, Griff O'Farrell at 2, who is another guy who a lot of people project to move off to second just because he doesn't have the biggest arm. He could still stick there and play there. And then Merrick Houston, who's not even in the 2024 class. So I think that's pretty representative of how scouts view this, like, shortstop grouping in the college class this year.
Yeah, and bringing up those names, it's a reminder as to how thin it was even going into the season, and now even more so with the lack of performance from Silva. And like, O'Farrell to me is a no doubt second baseman eventually professionally, but yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
He's been fine. He hasn't been great this year. He's also trended down. He started around the same range we had Anthony Silva, but I don't think it's been quite as concerning as Silva's offensive performance, certainly.
Yeah, no, like nothing alarming from O'Farrell. But with Silva, I think with him being sophomore eligible, he has some leverage. I don't know what he's going to do and what his dollar amount is. And there are a whole lot of variables to consider. He's someone else who's going to be playing on the Cape before the draft, maybe even longer, just depending on how that it all goes. But like, he has a chance to bounce back and bring back the Anthony Silva of 2023, at least to an extent on the Cape, which would serve him well. But like, does he go back for his junior year? It'll all be very interesting to watch unfold.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't want to end this on a downer note. I have one other player that I wanted to mention who has just performed really well the entire year. I think we have him inside the top 100 now, so it's not some completely off the board name, but I wonder if he's just pitching himself up into day one consideration. He has the advantage of throwing from the left side, which helps. The guy I'm talking about is Texas A&M lefty Ryan Prager. So just looking at, again, some of the numbers here, he is fifth in strikeout to walk rate. It's a 7.81 strikeouts per walk. And if you also just look at strikeout percentage minus walk rate, it's obviously pretty much the same thing. It's pretty high there. He's been phenomenal this year. It really feels like he's posted consistently through 12 starts for Texas A&M. It's a 2.67 ERA through 64 innings, 33.6% strikeout rate compared to 19% in that category a year ago. He's also cut the walk rate pretty much in half from 9.8% in 2022, I guess 2 years ago, to 4.3% this spring. He doesn't have the loudest pure stuff. It's a three pitch mix, fastball sitting around 90, getting up to like 93, 94. He's got a low 80s slider and a changeup that he pairs with it. But the fastball, the riding life metrics on that pitch are pretty loud, and he's just consistently posted. And we talk endlessly about the reliever questions and the strikes questions for a lot of pitchers in this class. Maybe that'll help Ryan Prager kind of separate himself. The fact that he is throwing strikes, the fact that he's performed, the fact that he's done it in the SEC, again, left-handed. I'm curious what his ultimate ceiling is going to be, just given how hard he throws. But he has certainly done everything that he can to move up boards.
Yeah, he's been excellent. And I think that the fastball, it plays up due to the noisiness, I think, of the metrics. You meant like it averages almost 23 inches of ride, and there's a little bit of cut to it. And there's also some natural funkiness in his delivery from that almost near over the top slot. I think you can even call it that. So all of that, it helps it play up a little bit. And then the slider is effective as well this year. And then the changeup, I think, is his kind of bread and butter secondary. He kills spin on it really well. It gets good separation off his fastball. It's generated a ton of whiffs this year. I'm with you on like the ceiling, like whether it's like kind of number four, like a fourth starter. But like, he could be a really effective one, and he's been consistently around the strike zone. I think he's throwing strikes at a 70% clip. He's got an advanced feel for his entire arsenal, that three pitch mix that you mentioned. So I think that he's someone that is going to continue to make himself a lot of money. And we see it almost every year, but at least more frequently than not in recent memory, these guys that go out and, you know, lead their teams to a deep run in the College World Series or to a national championship. And if A&M ends up dogpiling in Omaha, it's probably a safe bet to make that Ryan Prager is going to be a key reason as to why. So
yeah,
for me, he's like he's a third to fourth round type. He's a third to fourth round for me. But again, similar to Waldschmidt, like I wouldn't be like, whoa, if I see him go late on day one.
I mean, as we've been talking about him, like who would you rather have, Ryan Prager or Josh Hartle? I feel like Prager is having the season that I expected Josh Hartle to have. And if Josh Hartle was posting like Ryan Prager has been posting, he'd probably just still safely in that first round mix. But Ryan Prager's just been better in a conference that almost every scout is going to say is better, even if it's marginally so, over the SEC. And right now we've got Josh Hartle ahead, and I'm wondering if we have those wrong.
That's an interesting hypothetical, because right now, like, I'd take Ryan Prager. And I feel like you probably would too, but I mean, I'd take Prager over him. So it's interesting to see, like, it will be interesting to see how teams view him come July and just how high he can go again. I don't know if I'm pulling the trigger on that, like, day one, but
like, just thinking about it, I'm pulling up Josh Hartle's numbers right now, but he also is throwing a fastball that's kind of sitting right at 90, doesn't get super hard. Based on how you're talking about Prager's changeup, I mean, you can maybe make the case that Prager has the best secondary option of the two. Like, I don't know that Hartle has one pitch you can really feel confident in that is a super heavy bat misser. Certainly in terms of the miss rates he's generated with his pitches this year, he does not have one that has crossed the 40% threshold, and Prager has gotten a 52% miss rate with the changeup. Again, like, I don't want to read too terribly much into those numbers, but he's kind of done it this year, whereas Hartle has not. So, yeah. So Josh Hartle is averaging 90.3 with his fastball. He actually throws the cutter as often. So it's like cutter fastball for him, whereas mostly just fastball and riding fastball for Prager. So between just the swing and miss he's generating with the secondaries, the performance, and the fact that, like, I would imagine most teams would prefer the riding fastball characteristics compared to Josh Hartle's sinker cutter profile fastball, which the cutter has been better in the past, but it certainly doesn't seem as effective this year. So it's kind of an interesting player comparison that I'm making in real time here that is making me wonder about the rankings and endlessly want to tweak with them and figure out how to line these guys up.
Yeah, no doubt. It was a really interesting debate that you brought up, and like, it tipped me off to it. Like, I'd take Prager, so he'll be a really fun guy to follow down the stretch.
Yeah. So I guess, like always, work to do with these rankings. It's a never ending process of tweaking and tinkering and never feeling quite confident in them. So Peter, that's all I had for today. Any other players you want to mention?
No, that was it on my end. That was a really fun show.
Yeah, I'm glad we're back on the mic and breaking things down. Should be more consistent moving forward. No trips that are non-work related for me in the foreseeable future. So just back to business for us. Anything you want to plug before we get out of here?
Yeah, just the usual stuff going on over at baseballamerica.com for me. Top 25 on Monday, Hot Sheet Tuesday. My weekly What to Watch For, as well as the college podcast with Teddy on Thursday. And then the draft podcast that you're listening to right now will be out every Friday, as well as some supplemental pieces sprinkled in there. So a lot of stuff on the amateur side, and then also professionally and with prospects. Really anything you're looking for is over at baseballamerica.com.
Yeah, we just started the early stages of planning for our draft preview issue of the magazine. So we'll all be working on that over the next few weeks and months. So that's always an exciting time of the year. I think we're probably overdue for another staff draft. Those are always fun. I imagine if Peter has the first pick, you probably know who he's going to take in that one. But we'll have to randomize the order and fire it up and go again, see how much has changed from version one to version two. But otherwise, yeah, business as usual at BA. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for supporting the site. Thanks for supporting us and following along. For Peter, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.